No shortage of stories as we wrap up November. Welcome back to the CBSSports.com College Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Norlander. If you are not already subscribed on iTunes, be sure to do that. You know, make it your Christmas present or holiday present. Hanukkah, Festivus, they're all coming in a few weeks here. Make that the present to me. Go to iTunes, search for CBS Sports College Hoops Podcast, or some variation of that. It'll pop up. Subscribe and help us keep climbing the rankings. Appreciate everyone that's done that so far. And we're actually bringing on Seth Davis, who's been on the pod plenty of times and is a fan of the podcast. He tells me he listens to it when he works out, so that that means a lot. Seth, thanks for that. I appreciate it, man. How are you doing? And how's life?
Life is good. I will not be listening to this one while I work out, because the last thing I need to do while I'm working out is hear myself talk. But no, I actually have a good routine, because it takes me about an hour to get through everything. So for about maybe the first 20, 25 minutes, I'll listen to a college basketball podcast, either yours or the one from that other place.
Now, good old Cats and the ESPN. There is no
Cats and Greenberg. You know, they have a nice they have a minion over there, and they throw in Bruce Pearl.
Exactly.
A lot of MOTs on the pod. And then about 20, 25 minutes through, I'll switch over to my music, and that'll power me through. I can't take you for the whole workout, but kind of get me into the workout, and then I flip over to the music.
Well, first of all, I figure listening to Parrish and Goodman would actually be a good thing, because it actually builds up the anger within you, so you really get that workout, that physicality as a factor in. So that's nothing but good things. But music-wise, I know you're a huge fan of The Radiators. That's your favorite band of all time, a band out of New Orleans who is sadly, I think, hung it up. But aside from The Radiators, let the people know what Seth Davis listens to. And if it's guilty pleasures, do not hold back on me, man.
Well, between The Radiators and Springsteen, that's about two-thirds right there.
Okay.
A lot of Grateful Dead, so that's another big chunk. And then, you know, might have a little, you know, Copacabana by Manilow pop up here and there, or some of the songs from Book of Mormon might pop in there. And yes, I will confess that if I really want to rock the workout, I will blast Hail to the Redskins.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, huge Redskins fan. Nice, a little Broadway. Nothing wrong with that. I do own Jesus Christ Superstar on vinyl. Proud to say it. Not afraid at all.
Vinyl, wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, when you own Broadway music on vinyl, you are some sort of insufferable. So I openly admit to that. And yep. My fiance's father randomly had it. I was like, yeah, I'll take it. So I didn't actually like go to the record store seeking it out. It was passed on to me.
But that's
good stuff, man. All right, let's go to the hoops, because we have so much. We'll get to Kentucky first, because that's the most immediate thing. We're recording this podcast right here on Friday morning. And that Kentucky-Notre Dame game was pretty interesting. I mean, you just love watching Manti Te'o, you know, front of the student section, leading the charge, the rushing of the floor. I thought that was great. You get that on occasion. You'll see, you know, whenever a basketball school happens to be on TV, you know, on the heels or in the midst of their team, football team's great season, you'll get a star or two in the mix. And Te'o was doing that. But the thing afterwards, so Notre Dame wins big. Bray does this. He gets two or three really nice standout wins every year. You know, they've suffered in the tournament just a little bit, and so maybe that's why we don't consider Notre Dame to be a top 20 program nationally, and maybe not. That's fine. But Bray does a great job, gets a nice win over Kentucky, and people were saying, you know, this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, and that's true. It shouldn't have been, because, one, Notre Dame was favored. They were at home. They're a good team. But I found the margin surprising, and I know Kentucky's got issues. They're still factoring Harrow back into the offense, but it's okay that we can be surprised that Kentucky lost by that much, right, Seth? What were your takeaways from that game?
Well, yeah, the margin didn't even indicate how much of a dominant performance it was by Notre Dame. I mean, Kentucky actually made a push at the end to make it to a more respectable margin. So, I mean, it's surprising, but it's not shocking. I mean, clearly Kentucky has issues at the point guard position. This we know. I mean, I think this would have been the case regardless of whether Ryan Harrell was healthy or not. I mean, you know, when someone's at a place for a couple of years and then he transfers, to me there's always a reason that he transfers. So he was always going to suffer by comparison to Marcus Teague and Derrick Rose and, you know, all the great point guards that Calipari has had. So now for him to go through these health and personal issues where he's been away for a couple of weeks, only played 9 minutes last night, then now something that was already a concern becomes a pretty sizable deficiency. So that's number one. I expect that to get better. But, I mean, let's face it, this is not a team with the kind of talent as last year. But more important, Matt, everyone remembers last year's team for the freshmen, obviously, but we got to keep in mind that they also had some experienced guys and in key leadership positions. You know, a guy like Darius Miller, who was a senior, was huge for that team, even though he wasn't starting. And then you had Deron Lamb and Terrence Jones. So those were three of their top six players who had significant playing experience. Now their most experienced guy is Kyle Wiltshire, and he barely played last year. So it's not that the talent isn't there. And also, we'll say this, Matt, I'm sure you'll agree. I mean, everybody, and I just, you know, am guilty of it right now, everybody tries to compare this team to last year's Kentucky team. But you know what? They don't have to beat last year's Kentucky team. They only had to beat Notre Dame. You know, they only have to beat this year's Indiana or this year's Duke. And if you look at the talent that Kentucky has, it's certainly comparable to any team in the country. They just don't have the toughness and the experience and the leadership right now on the court to be able to go into a place like the Joyce Center and go up against a veteran, older team like Notre Dame and win that game. But, you know, it's today's what, December 1st or November 30th? I don't even know what date it is, but it's
November 30th here.
It's early. Yes. It's early. And I think we've seen this movie from Calipari before. They'll get better. I don't think they'll win a championship. I don't think anyone would say that right now, but they will certainly get better than they played last night.
I think they will. I mean, the game last night reminded me of Kentucky, South Carolina. What was it, a year and a half ago or whatever? They went on the road, just got beat. I mean, Kentucky was more competitive in that game, but there was I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in correlating the two, but I got flashbacks to that. And just, you know, Kentucky looked vulnerable. They looked human. They looked like they had issues. And it could be some point guard stuff for sure. Harrow, who knows? I mean, I've always thought Harrow was bound to be the least talented of Cal's point guards if you start with the run of Rose at Memphis and lead it up to now. We'll see what they can do there. You know, some Kentucky fans... you see, the reason I know that Kentucky fans are kind of a little nervous is plenty of them are good. I mean, listen, a lot of them are so funny and really get it on Twitter. But, you know, I made one little crack at them. You know, I said, you see Kentucky losing in one Indiana town and you understand why Calipari won't go play in another, referring to the Bloomington,
right?
You know, Indiana. And instantly, I mean, 20 responses right away. Do your research. They were going to play in Rupp this year. What a terrible take. And if Kentucky fans are truly, like, if they're truly confident about their team overall, I mean, I made some cracks against them, you know, against, like I do, it's Twitter, who cares? Last year, you didn't get that. I mean, so, yes, this is a different team. It isn't last year's team by any means. We need to avoid comparing the two. I just wonder if, you know, Calipari does this for a reason. I mean, he told us before the season this was going to happen, Seth. I mean, he said, listen, this team's going to have some true stumbling blocks. It's of my opinion that in the year 2025, we're going to look back and say, you know, from 2000 to 2015, that 2011-2012 Kentucky team was the best, if not the second best team out there. Like, I just think that as we get further away from it, we're going to see how special that group was. To me, this team's going to be good, not great. They could be a one seed, sure, but it takes time to get all that talent to gel. And just because they're Kentucky doesn't necessarily mean that we should automatically expect them to do huge things. Kind of similarly to how USC football this year picked number one in the preseason, they end up losing five games. Like, there's just nothing guaranteed here.
Well, I mean, the thing that bothered me most about watching them last night is that they just didn't seem to have much fight in them. You know, I mean,
yes,
they got down a big margin. I mean, you almost wanted someone to throw a punch and get thrown out of the game just because he was so pissed, you know. And I just, their body language was awful, awful. I mean, they're kind of laid back guys, and again, that's where that upper class leadership, you know, is really missed. But like I said, it's early, and you know, these comparisons to last year are obviously going to be inevitable. But that's what you get when you put on a Kentucky jersey, and they definitely have a lot to figure out. That's for sure.
Yeah, and we'll see. Listen, there are no shortage of tests coming up here. I mean, they get Baylor next tomorrow. So as we record this podcast, if you happen to have had a delayed weekend, aren't going to get to Sunday until Sunday, and they've lost to Baylor, then you know that's a whole other set of issues. But that's a home game. They should win.
Well, let's go on record since
people
listening beforehand. So they're back in Rupp. I like Kentucky to win. Who do you like?
I like Kentucky by a close 10 points. So maybe it's close throughout the game, but in the final.
We don't know right now if Brady Heslip is going to play, by the way. You know, he had an appendectomy.
Right.
So he missed their last game, which they lost at home, the College of Charleston. But I was texting with Scott Drew, and he said they're just kind of wait till the day of the game to decide. But they certainly, if they don't have him, it's going to be that much of a taller order coming off a loss, 48-hour turnaround. I'm going to be interested just again, how hard do they play? How hard do they compete? You know, you should be really angry right now if you're Kentucky. You just got embarrassed. You know, a Heisman Trophy guy just ran on the court. And, you know, you should be really, really angry. And I want to see them play angry against Baylor.
And what dovetailed last night was you had Kentucky losing big and Florida just absolutely smashed a Marquette team that I think will get better, that I think is going to go to the tournament, but does not have the pieces it's had for the past 4 years under Buzz Williams. So right now, Florida is considered, rightfully so, the best team in the SEC by most people. And I'm a guy who's been down, relatively speaking, on Florida. I haven't seen Florida as a top 10 team. I'm in a super minority with that. And I'm about willing to concede on that point here. But do you consider Florida to be a team in the bigger picture that will consistently be a better team, the better team than Kentucky going forward? Is the SEC now belonging to the Gators, not just in the here and now, but mid-January into February? What are you forecasting, Seth?
Well, I'm kind of with you on the Gators. You know, I'm always a little bit skeptical because I want to see what they have. And sometimes because of their talent, they can leave you wanting more, you know. But obviously that was not the case last night. I mean, between that game, the Kentucky game, and the news coming out of Missouri, which we'll get to, you'd have to say that Florida's the best team in the SEC. You know, they get this great, you know, game from their freshman, Michael Frazier, coming off the bench and dropping 17 points. And what I really liked about them, Matt, was I liked how they defended. You know, Donovan's playing a lot of zone. I know he's used that zone before, but I don't know that I've seen him in quite some time play quite that much zone. And, you know, he's got some size and length on the front line. They benched Patrick Young, so they brought him off the bench. I thought that he responded well. He's never going to be a great offensive player. You know, he's one of those guys who leaves you wanting more. Kenny Boynton absolutely drives you wild. Couldn't make anything last night. But, I mean, that's not a terrible team that they beat. It's not a great team by any stretch. But, I mean, they didn't just beat them. I mean, they just – you know, as Barkley would say, they beat them like they stole something, you know, and they did it with the pressure defense, dropping back into the zone and beating them up on the boards, you know, out rebounding them by 11. So that, you know, that toughness and defensive personality is what Florida's lacked the last few years. And it's a great attribute to take into the NCAA tournament. And no one knows that more than Buzz Williams, because his teams usually bring that, and they certainly did not last night.
You nail it on the head, Seth, the toughness and defensive personality, because right now Florida is a top five team in offense and defense in KenPom.com adjusted efficiency. They have not been that since, of course, you guessed it, they won the national title. Actually, their first one, they were top five in both. Their second one, they were 12th overall at the end of the year, and defense was still pretty solid. And in the past 4 or 5 years, that has not been the case. Florida has not been a reliable defensive team. They are that right now. This is still, you know, they're only 6 games into their season, and we'll see what happens. They've got challenges ahead. They could easily lose one of their next 2 games. They get Florida State at Florida State, and they're at Arizona. Now, the good news is, you know, the finals are mixed in there, so it's only 2 games in the next 16 days, basically. So it's not like they're going to have a Kentucky situation, Notre Dame, and then Baylor, basically back-to-back. But we'll see. And then we'll tag in here with Missouri, because Missouri's got a lot going on. They're a team that I on a lark picked to win the national title in the preseason before I knew Michael Dixon would be suspended and ultimately have to leave the team. So we can just go full on with Missouri right now. If you're listening to the podcast, there was a tiny little side note that broke on Friday. There were some secondary violations with Missouri and its coaching staff and recruiting and some on-campus event. It's nothing huge. It's not a huge thing, but just a minor thing that's almost an afterthought in the wake of Michael Dixon having to leave. And just so I can really deliver the news in full here, Michael Dixon is out at Missouri because although he was not ever charged by the police, he's actually been accused of sexual assault / rape twice. The first one actually became the second one because it happened in 2010. We did not know that was a story or even happened until Thursday night. St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I believe, was the first to report that story. So you got these two cases. He was never charged, but the Missouri Student Conduct Board basically said, listen, you know, that's fine, but we've got what we've got here. We've heard your case, and you're done. So he's out. I don't know, thoughts on Missouri. We can go whatever way you want to go with this. I mean, the story itself, which is dicey, because we get into these rape allegations, and you just they're forever, unfortunately, hazy. You just don't know what to believe, what's right, what's wrong, and so you can, you know, as a Duke alum, Seth, I mean, you have a certain connection to this with the lacrosse, only, you know, because that was like the most infamous one ever. This is by no means the same kind of deal. But that kind of set the precedent for let's kind of pump the brakes on all sort of, you know, blame, putting the horse ahead of the cart, excuse me.
Yeah.
Thoughts on Mizzou.
It seems that, you know, my reading is that nobody ever brought any charges against him.
Right.
And I read in detail the complaint that this most recent person filed against him, or the statement that she gave. And it certainly didn't seem real clear to me that, you know, about what had happened. So I anybody certainly, you know, is entitled to the presumption of innocence in our legal system. And at best, and I obviously want to be careful here, but you know, the reports that I read were at best inconclusive, but the fact that he was involved in a situation prior to this obviously comes into play.
Yes.
And I've always, you know, tried to make the distinction where, you know, while I will vehemently always, and as we all should, argue and point out that in our criminal justice system, everybody, whether you're Jerry Sandusky, whoever you are, everybody is entitled to the presumption of innocence at the outset. By the same token, that is not true in the context of a basketball team or an athletic program or a university or any kind of school. You know, that's a different set of standards. You know, playing basketball for the Missouri Tigers is a great privilege. That is not a right. The presumption of innocence is a legal right. Playing basketball for Missouri is not a right. And I have to say, I was quite surprised, maybe not by the end of this thing, but, you know, just having been in the Bahamas, you know, with Missouri, you know, the fact that Dixon was there sort of fed a lot of speculation that he was on the verge of getting reinstated. And in fact, it was kind of a day-to-day thing. Now, Frank Haith was obviously being very coy about this information. And now that we know the information, I understand why. You know, he was kind of indicating that, you know, he could be reinstated any day. So I guess it was in the hands of the chancellor, whatever was going on with the university board. So I think we were all under the assumption that Dixon was going to come back. Having watched the team play for three consecutive days, I can tell you they're going to miss him very much. Because the one thing that Missouri really doesn't have right now is a good outside shooter. And Dixon isn't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily think of him as a great pure shooter, but he's certainly a great perimeter scorer. And, you know, really, I think would have given the team a great confidence and presence on the perimeter at both ends of the floor. Of course, he was a sixth man last year, was going to be the starter, kind of carry the load, and a guy who can score a lot but also set up for other players. So now you have the option of moving Flip Pressey off the ball. So, you know, now fortunately for them, from a basketball standpoint, they have a lot more going on up front with Alex Oriaki and Lawrence Bowers being back, and even Ernest Ross, who I think can really help them on the offensive glass, a 6'6", very, very strong guard who transferred in from Auburn. And, of course, they have Jabari Brown. Now, he's kind of the X factor here, Matt, because, I mean, we only saw him for two games and not really saw him.
No one saw him at Oregon, right.
Yeah, so who knows? But, I mean, Frank, you know, said to me he's just a really, really good shooter, really score, very high hopes. And now without Dixon being there, he'll have that much more opportunity to play. So, like you said, still a work in progress, a lot of pieces there. But it's not that Michael Dixon was like some first-team All-American. But given what this team lacks and what this team needs, I think not having him is really a huge blow moving forward.
Yeah, definitely a solid piece. And we are planning on having a piece with Michael Dixon at CBSSports.com. If not by over the weekend, maybe early next week. I don't want to make any promises, but that is what we are trying to arrange right now. So as you listen to the podcast, swing back around and maybe we'll have more from his side. We'll see. This is the same thing that happened with Desmond Wells, basically, at Xavier. I don't want to say the same thing, similar situation, because he was accused of rape. That case completely fell through, but the school decided, no, you were done. So he had to leave. I mean, the team did not want him to leave. And he's at Maryland. We'll see what Dixon does, if he decides to transfer or if he wants to pursue a pro career. I don't know. We'll see. You were in the Bahamas. That means you saw a whole lot of good teams. But most notably, was Duke, the team that won it. And right now, Duke and Indiana are in this. It's, you know, it's funny. Early in the season, national sports media that doesn't really follow college basketball. Hey, I'm happy if there's even one or two topics that kind of that filter into the mainstream and are picked up. And right now, it's Duke or Indiana who's the number one team. I'm not really interested in that because it doesn't really mean anything. Duke's clearly got the better resume. They've had an incredible start to the season, so I'd rather just talk about how Duke has proved a lot of people wrong. I mean, I thought they would be good. I didn't know they'd be this good, but I was one of the few who thought they would win the ACC. Obviously, I still think that. So, Duke, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Well, I'm surprised. And just to establish my street cred, as someone who I said I listened to this podcast, I listened to when you had Mike DeCourcy on.
Yes.
And I guess you quoted to him something I said on Twitter, kind of, you know, diminishing or demeaning Duke. And he said, well, you know, Seth is overcompensating because he went there. You know what? There's truth to that. A lot of people ask me, you know, because I went to Duke, gosh, is it hard for you to criticize Duke? My answer is always, well, it's much harder for me to praise Duke because when I do, everyone just says, oh, you just because you went to Duke. So, yeah. You know, having said that, I will lavish praise on them. They're terrific. And, you know, certainly – I don't think anybody could have, you know, having not been down there in the preseason or in the summertime, could have really foreseen the improvement of Mason Plumlee. I mean, you know, to me, when you're in college for 3 years, I mean, obviously you're still a young person and a young player, but by the time you reach the end of your junior year, from the standpoint of a college basketball player, you pretty much are what you are. And, you know, I mean, Mason looked very hard at going to the NBA last year, and really going into the tournament had basically made up his mind. And he and his brother Miles had talked about, hey, we're going to go to the NBA together. And, you know, when they lost to Lehigh, I think it kind of dawned on him to say, hey, if I was really this great basketball player ready for the NBA, how could I not carry my team past the first round in the NCAA tournament? So for him to be playing right now, I mean, I think you make a very strong case for him right now as National Player of the Year.
Definitely.
You know, for what he's done, and particularly on the free throw line. I mean, you very rarely, Matt, you know this, you're a numbers geek like me, you very rarely see a player improve his free throw shooting 20 percentage points. That, to me, it's almost mathematically impossible from one year to the next. And again, to do it this late in his career, you know, when he was a sophomore, he made 44% from the foul line. So to go from 44% to almost 80%, is incredible to me, and it's really mostly mental. You know, Coach K had him change his routine. Don't think so much, just get up there and shoot him. So I think what it really speaks to is just the value of experience and chemistry and having experience in the right places. So they have that three-man nucleus of Mason Plumlee, who's a senior, Ryan Kelly, who's a senior, and Seth Curry, who's a fifth-year senior. So they not only have – like last – we talked about Kentucky last year – you know, they had some experience too, but their, you know, their best guy was still Anthony Davis. For Duke, their best players are their oldest players. Their most important guys are their oldest guys. And I think that there's just a huge advantage during a season in which there's not, you know, huge, huge talent. Now having said all of that, I still don't think people are really focusing on this Seth Curry situation, which to me, again, is almost unprecedented that I can remember. He has chronic pain in his lower left leg. They're not really saying what it is. I've heard like shin splints or whatever, but they're basically talking about a situation that's going to be there all season long. And that to me is not shin splints. I think, you know, I'm thinking something along the lines of a stress reaction or somewhere where something structurally is compromised in his leg. But the bottom line is he basically doesn't practice. And when he does practice, he's only in maybe half the practice. And then half the stuff that he's doing is pretty light. So now, again, he's a fifth-year senior, so he knows how to play, and he knows how to play with his teammates. But I just wonder, Matt, over the course of a four-month season and the high-level games that he's playing, just in terms of his staying in – I mean, how do you stay in shape if you're not practicing? Because not only do you lose those, you know, 2 to 3 hours on the floor with your teammates, you know, he's obviously a great pure shooter, so he's a guy who likes to get in the gym in the morning and at night and get his shots up, getting his reps with his teammates. You know, before their first game of the Bahamas, Coach K said, you know what, I don't know if he's going to play all 3 days down here. And then, you know, I saw him at the reception for all the teams on Wednesday night, and he's walking around in a boot. And he said to me that every time they've played a game, he's had at least 1, if not 2 days off. So he played three games in 3 days, basically did it in practice, and you saw against Ohio State, he had nothing. So I just wonder over the course of the season, at what point is that going to come back to bite them? But that aside, obviously, you know, their resume and who they, you know, they've beaten three top eight teams, whether or not you think they should be number one or whether or not you think they're the best team in the country, they have by far the best resume to this point in the season.
They do. A few thoughts off that. One, the resume, if people, let's just let the people know, I mean, beat Kentucky, beat Minnesota, VCU, Louisville, Ohio State, all teams I think are going to cruise into the NCAA tournament. Even Minnesota, I think, will get there without too much trouble. And then the other wins over Florida Gulf Coast and Georgia State. I will counter with that. There are no doubt Duke haters listening. None of those wins are on the road. That's fine. You don't play in the tournament on the road. But I understand there's some value and some barometer to winning and playing on the road. That said, Duke doesn't get his first road game of the season until January 12th at NC State. That should be pretty interesting. Secondarily, Plumlee's free throw stuff is amazing. I wonder if there won't be a natural slight regression, okay, because you just don't see this. And it's something that I would love to research and write on. I just don't know if there's any precedent for this and how I could find it. He's shot more free throws than anyone on the team, which makes it even more impressive. He's at 79%, 45 for 57 on the year. So it's not like he's only gotten to the line like 24 times in a smaller sample size. No, he has gotten to the stripe more than anyone. And when it comes to foul shots, you know, it doesn't matter if it looks pretty. All that matters is if it goes in. You know, the granny underhand shot that Barry shot back in the day kind of proves that. So great for him. And then you're way ahead on the Seth Curry stuff. It's a great point. We'll see going forward what happens. Have no idea. Duke's just one of those programs where they just don't let a lot of stuff out. So this Curry injury could remain a mystery for as long as the season is. So we'll see what happens. They do intrigue me. I would put them clearly as the best team in the ACC right now. I think there's clear separation between them and NC State, who early on we're seeing could have had some overrated aspects to them. We'll see what Gottfried can do with that team, but they're learning that it's not easy to be Duke or Carolina. You know, it's not easy to have people looking at you, putting the target right on your back and expecting you to win. We'll see. I don't want to keep you too much longer here, but we do have to get to UCLA because start of the week, that was everything. You know, basically until Duke had that convincing win over Ohio State and then the Kentucky stuff and the Missouri stuff. It was all UCLA, and it still kind of is. Tyler Lamb is gone, and Josh Smith have gone. They've both transferred out of the school this week. They lost to Cal Poly on Sunday night. They blew an 18-point lead. It was a miserable loss. I can't say this is the nadir of the Ben Howland era, because you can't say that because of the team and the talent he has, what he's been able to recruit. But this week is an interesting microcosm into what Ben Howland at UCLA has become. I've remained skeptical, Seth, all the while of Shabazz having big time, like, transcendent impact on that program. Saw him on the AU circuit, loved him, but wasn't like blown away. Like Nerlens Noel blew me away. Shabazz didn't necessarily blow me away. I don't know. I have doubts. Like, I think UCLA is going to get to the tournament, but they could be a 5 or 6 seed, and I just wonder if ultimately that's going to be enough to save Howland's job. What are your thoughts on everything that's happened with this program from Josh Smith transferring? I think that's a good thing. To what Howland can, should do, is able to do going forward with this team that clearly has just more issues than the day is long.
Well, it's hard to imagine a worse week.
Yeah.
For a team, including the loss to Cal Poly. You know, it's Ben's in a tough spot. I mean, we all know this is a make or break year for him. I think it was closer than a lot of people realized to him not coming back. And obviously, the recruiting class that he brought in is what saved him. Of all the things that happened, the thing that shocked me the most was Tyler Lamb, because I think they need him. You know, I look at UCLA. I mean, Josh Smith is just a disaster. I mean, I don't like to impugn the character of a kid. You know, for all we know, there's personal issues going on.
I think there's got to be depression. I've had a few, just a real quick thing. I mean, I've had a few friends who have been tied to this, and they're not huge Hoops fans, but they kind of follow. And privately, they're like, there's no way this isn't depression. So it could be super serious with the kid.
Right.
We'll see.
So we'll have that caveat. It's very sad to see, for whatever reason, and I say this with great respect and affection and sympathy, somebody completely waste such God-given talent. I mean, with his size, his hands, and his feet, you'd have to, you need a wheelbarrow to carry the money that is out there waiting for him. If he just had the makeup, the mental makeup, and the discipline, really is all about his eating to get his body to where it needs to be able to compete at this high level. So whatever issues he's working through, you know, I truly hope that he finds some resolution there, because it's just sad to me to see somebody, you know, waste all that talent. It's certainly not a devastating blow to the program, because he wasn't getting that. But by the same token, you know, he was a big time recruit out of Seattle, and it's definitely hurt them that he hasn't developed the way they needed him to develop. So maybe at the end of the day, like they say, at, you know, in Fletch, at the, when it was very, very sudden at the end, like maybe there it wasn't very, very sudden. But the arc of the narrative of Josh Smith is very devastating for the program. But Tyler Lamb, again, to me, I mean, he was an older guy who could score on the wing and get some stability. And I just thought there would be minutes available for him. He's been recovering from his knee surgery, so he hasn't been able to play. But that just really surprised me. So, you know, Ben is up against it. I mean, I've always thought very highly of him as a coach. But, you know, I really believe that coaching, Matt, is much more about your situation than whether or not you're good. I mean, I always use the example of Doc Rivers. I mean, he gets fired by the Magic, hired by the Celtics, and wins a championship. And he was the same guy, but he was just in a different situation. And I just wonder if this situation with Ben is so far gone that it can be recovered. I'm not saying I'm giving up on them, but, you know, they're playing San Diego State this weekend, and that game's in Anaheim, and I think there's going to be more Aztec fans there than UCLA fans, because UCLA fans now, they just don't turn out. Now, they expect you to win like Kentucky and Indiana, but they won't do their part like Kentucky fans and Indiana fans do. So they already put you in a difficult situation. So we'll see. I think the league is better. So, you know, this notion that they're automatically going to the tournament, I'm not quite there. Mm-hmm. We'll see. But it was a really, really, really bad week for a guy who, frankly, has had more than his fair share of bad weeks to now.
Can I get you on the record just to expound a little bit on Muhammad and what kind of impact you expect from him, how he fits into this scheme, you know, if Anderson is even being put in the right place? I mean, doesn't it seem like we still have to shift a lot of things going on? What do you think? What should people expect from Muhammad, who are basically hearing, yeah, top five pick? Well, he hasn't, you know, he still looks a little out of shape. What should people expect? Is there going to be a turnaround there?
Well, I'm actually kind of with you on Shabazz, because I saw him, you know, probably as much as I saw anybody on the recruiting circuit. I'm not a huge recruiting guy, but, I go to, you know, a handful of events, so I see a lot of the main guys. And so I'm kind of with you on the notion that he wasn't – I mean, he's not LeBron. I mean, obviously nobody is LeBron, but, you know, that he was not going to be some unbelievably great player coming in. And obviously the layoff and coming in late is a little bit of a hindrance there. But, I mean, he's definitely solid. The fact that he's a top five pick or a top 10 pick, it's not a very strong draft. I actually think the greater concern for them is Kyle Anderson, because he's a guy who you hear a lot of mixed things about him from – NBA people and other coaches, because he's not a great athlete. So what really, you know, made him valuable was the fact that he was a unique player at 6'8", could handle the ball. I mean, people compared him to Magic, because obviously not that he's as good as Magic, really 6'9". But now he comes to UCLA and Larry Drew is the main point guard. So if he doesn't have his hands on the ball and he's not a great athlete, what's he giving you? Well, he's giving you not even 7 points a game and, you know, three assists and change. So to me, he seems a little bit misplaced right now. They have a lot of issues they need to work through.
You can follow Seth on Twitter. I know you already are if you're on Twitter, but if not, Seth Davis Hoops. And he's got one of the best smorgasbord-type columns out there with hoop thoughts on SI.com. It's up there. I mean, it's once a week, if not twice, right? I mean, you're kind of a...
Well, you know what? We're switching it over. Usually the hoop thoughts comes out Monday. We're moving it to Thursday.
Okay, there we go.
They're gonna present it. They're gonna take what Peter King, what they do with Peter King and Stuart Mandel for football, and pair me with an NBA.
Oh, okay.
And blow it up a little bit on Thursday. So hopefully it'll all work out.
No, it's good stuff. Be sure to check it out. Follow Seth on Twitter. And hey, I appreciate it, man.
Hey. My pleasure, man. Enjoy listening to you.
All right. Very good. You can also check him out on CBS Sports. He'll be doing studio work per usual going forward. So look forward to that. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great, happy weekend, everyone. Enjoy the hoops. And if you're out getting a Christmas tree or whatever you're doing, enjoy that as well. Talk to you soon. Thanks so much.